If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 573. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about hiking and musk oxen and glaciers, flight seeing and First Nations as we go to the Yukon Territories in Canada. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. A funny thing happened to me in July, right around the beginning of the month. I got an email that said, how would you like to come to the Yukon next week? It's an interesting thing sometimes being a travel blogger and podcaster, but it can lead to some interesting opportunities, and I want to tell you about it in this episode. But without further ado, let's talk about the Yukon. I'd like to welcome the show Stephen Reynolds from Tourism Yukon, who's come to talk to us, strangely enough, about the Yukon. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I am violating my own unwritten rule here about not having people from the tourism board come on, and we do that just because I'm always looking for an authentic voice, but I feel that Stephen has one. And besides, I'm going to talk about some of the places we ate, and you picked all of those, so that should be of use to that. So I was just in the Yukon, and I was there with Stephen and some of his colleagues on a last-minute trip for me, a trip planned much more in advance for you guys. I want to talk about what we did there, but also what people should do to the Yukon. But why don't we start with why should someone come to the Yukon, and start with in the summer, because that's where we were there, and it's a very different place in the summer than in the winter.
Absolutely. It's like two other worlds just a few months apart. So in terms of your guests and potential guests giving some consideration to a summer visit, the north in general is fascinating in the summertime, mainly because of the midnight sun. A lot of people who live down in the lower 48 and southern Canada and other places that we call south, you still have darkness and night, right, and skies with stars and moons and things like that all through July and August and June. We don't. So starting around the end of May, our sky goes light during the night and it stays bright, if you will, throughout the entire night until early in August. So most of our visitors from the south find that that phenomenon alone is worth the energy and effort it takes to come up here in the summer, because it's something that most humans don't get to experience. So the midnight sun is predominant. It's there every day. I can guarantee you're going to see midnight sun whenever you come up to the Yukon in June, July, or August. And from an activity perspective, the Yukon is just a little bit larger than the state of California, with only 38,000 people living here. So space is an amazing quality that we have lots of, and vistas that are unimpeded are something else that the Yukon is quite famous for.
You say 38,000 people, but it's not like it's completely unpopulated. There's also five times as many caribou as people and twice as many moose.
That's true. The caribou and the moose greatly outnumber the human beings, but the humans tend to stay in the cities, and certainly when you fly into Whitehorse, you'll see more humans than moose or caribou.
Well, and we talk about Whitehorse, and Whitehorse is where we spent a lot of time in the capital of the Yukon, almost back to its peak population of the gold rush days in the Klondike gold rush in the late 1800s. Not quite back to that number yet in terms of Whitehorse, but most of the population of the whole province, well, of the whole territory, sorry, is in Whitehorse. And Whitehorse is only barely in the Yukon.
Well, we are in the banana belt down in the south part of the Yukon. We're about, we're just under 61 degrees parallel. And yes, you're correct that Whitehorse is the capital city of the Yukon and the center of many levels of government and other industries. So we have about 28,000 of the 38,000 living here in Whitehorse. Once you get outside of Whitehorse, the next largest town is Dawson City, which is 6 hours drive north of Whitehorse. And its population fluctuates in around the 2,000 people mark. So there's a substantial difference once you step out of Whitehorse. And a good friend of mine likes to say that Whitehorse is wonderful because it's only 15 minutes from the real Yukon.
And you say in the banana belt.
Yes.
There are no banana trees in the Yukon.
No, there are no banana trees. And fruit trees are really shrubs like blueberries and raspberries and strawberries. But Whitehorse tends to be much warmer than Dawson City in the wintertime. And so we affectionately call ourselves the banana belt down here, whereas the people in Dawson City will certainly see minus 40 or minus 45 almost every winter guaranteed. In the summertime, it's reversed. Dawson City is typically warmer than Whitehorse. And that's all to do with latitude and midnight sun and the way things happen up here in terms of weather.
And you say it's warmer then, but we were there over the 4th of July weekend. Or I was there over the 4th of July weekend, and it was predominantly shirt sleeve weather. Dawson may be warmer, but the Yukon in this time of year with so much sunlight is a fairly comfortable place. Some rain, some clouds, but predominantly shirt sleeve weather in terms of temperature. And I did see it start to try and get dark at midnight. I think I may even have a photo someplace of what looks like a sunset at about midnight. And I had to wake up in the middle of the night to basically see anything that looked like dusk because I would go to sleep at night and it would still be light out or mostly light out, and you'd go walk home for some event that we did, and I always found myself always walking to the hotel because it's still light out.
No, it's very true. We have daylight and dusk, and that's about it. I mean, officially we have no night for about almost 60 days of the calendar year. Quite a fascinating thing.
Let's talk about some of the highlights first. In terms of things to do, one of the things that I got to do you haven't quite got to do yet, and it was because you were a really nice guy, and that is we went flight seeing at one of the nearby national parks, the Kluane National Park.
Yeah, that's right. Kluane National Park and Reserve, you're right.
Which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
It is part of the world's largest UNESCO World Heritage Site, combining British Columbia, the Yukon, and the state of Alaska.
Not the entire state or the entire British Columbia.
Well, right. The park stretches into all three jurisdictions.
And we had a chance to do a flight seeing tour. Now, I think you've done the flight seeing.
That's correct.
We got to land on a glacier, on the Hubbard Glacier. So first of all, we're talking about the largest non-polar ice fields in the world, or possibly Chile is going to make some argument about that, but at least one of the top two, and I believe we were told the largest non-polar ice field. So just ice everywhere, snow everywhere, spectacular scenery as you fly in this small plane up the valley where the glacier has carved and fly relatively low over the glacier and see the different moraines in the glacier and the crevasses and the incredibly blue pools of water, a tidy bowl blue water here in these little pools in the glacier just was fascinating, as well as gigantic mountains in the background with snow and clouds going over them. And the weather was very cooperative for our trip, and have these spectacular photos of this amazing flight. And then we got to land, which you haven't had a chance to do yet. The thing that surprised me is you're going over this glacier and it's rough, right? It's a river of ice, and you see all of these places where there are crevasses, and you see the places where it has stress fractures because it's turning a corner and the ice piles up and things like that. But when you're at the top, it's also covered with a layer of snow. And I thought it would be a rougher landing I really had this picture of we're not landing on a runway and not thinking, of course, that we're landing on several feet of snow on skis on a plane. And it was the smoothest, softest landing that I've ever had because we're landing on snow. And of course, you get out and you're sinking into the snow and trying to keep the plane from doing the same. And I would say that having landed on a glacier was an amazingly cool thing in terms of the sightseeing and the views. Probably the flight seeing was more interesting. So I'll give you that, you know, just so you know, Stephen, that you won't get any prettier by landing on the glacier. It's just pretty cool that you can.
Yeah.
Even more cool when you can take off again. That's the thing that you're very grateful for. It takes a little bit of runway and a little bit of airplane power on these very powerful engines on these small planes. But that is by far the highlight. And basically, when I got invited up to the Yukon and they said, and one of the things you're going to do is, I said, yes, absolutely. Not an inexpensive trip. I think, what is it, almost $200 a person?
In U.S., it'd be around 200. Yeah, it's about three and a quarter in Canadian. And the exchange rate would put you in around the 200 mark in U.S. dollars.
But I would say worth it, definitely, if you can do that, if the weather cooperates, because obviously they can only do that in certain weather. That is absolutely something I would recommend.
Exactly. Yeah. Flight seeing is always sort of spectacular, whatever you're flying over, whether it's mountains or glacial scenery. But the novelty of being able to actually land on the glacier and then be within sight of Canada's tallest peak, Mount Logan, and the second tallest peak in North America, second only to Denali over in Alaska, which is only a few hundred miles away at that point. That's very unusual. I think we were talking with the pilots there and figuring out that there's sort of less than maybe 500 or 600 people so far in history that have landed up there and enjoyed that view that you got the other day.
Again, just awesome. So now, other things that are more common that more people do in terms of tourists there, I had a chance to do a brief hike. I think as a group, we didn't do any hikes. It just wasn't time in a packed press trip sort of thing. But that is going to be something that a lot of your guests are going to be doing. Do you have a favorite hike when based out of the Whitehorse area? So let's start with day hike, because I know you also do kind of the multi-day things.
Hiking and canoeing/kayaking are probably the two most common summer activities. In terms of day hikes around Whitehorse, there are several. Fish Lake is something that's very common here with certainly the local population, maybe not so much for tourists, but it's a beautiful hike, easy to drive to the trailhead, only about 30 minutes out of town, and you drive straight up, really, and gain elevation, and then hike further up for spectacular views of this very large lake, Fish Lake, and the surrounding area. Another one that's close to town is Gray Mountain. There's actually a road right to the top of it. It gets fairly rough at the end of the road. It's accessing a cell tower.
Okay, that's the one we saw in the distance from...
That's correct. Yeah, but so a good four-wheel drive or good clearance vehicle will make it up to the top, or you can park just below the last little rough stretch of road and then walk, and then basically you just walk along a ridge for as long as you want, turn around and come back. There are some companies that offer heli hiking, so they'll fly you up to the top of that mountain, and then you just hike down and get back to town. A little further afield, you'll get out towards the Carcross area. It's about a 45-minute drive, and there's some spectacular hikes there, Nares Mountain and Caribou Mountain. Both will take you 4 to 6 hours, depending on your hiking abilities, but get you up into some incredible vistas. And then for those who are a little more adventurous or planning to spend some more time concentrating on hiking, heading over to the Kluane National Park area where you went flight seeing, there are several, I'm going to say half a dozen well-known day hikes that can all be extended into overnight camping, backpacking trips if people have that desire. And they're everything from the Cottonwood Trail, King's Throne, Mount Archibald, the Oriole Trail. So there's a number of hikes that are over in that area. And now you are truly in the foothills of some of North America's tallest mountains. And you really get that spectacular mountain scenery coupled with endless forests and beautiful lakes. Hiking definitely is a thrill of the Yukon in summertime. Some people do it in the winter too, but we call that snowshoeing.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned going hiking along the ridge. And as I'm picturing that ridge in my head here, that is a granite outcropping that it basically looks, as you can tell, a lot of this area was glaciated. That was carved and rounded off by glaciers, as a lot of the landscape is in this area.
Absolutely. And that ridge for Gray Mountain that we were talking about, that's been stripped bare. So the hiking is quite simple. Once you get up on there, there's not a lot of obstacles in your way. The glaciers did a great job of clearing that trail for you.
Excellent. And you mentioned kayaking and canoeing. We had a chance to go in a Voyager canoe, which this was new to me. This is a 15-person canoe that's reminiscent of some of the big canoes the fur trappers would have used as they were opening up Canada. So a lot of the French fur trappers especially. So not necessarily in this area. That wouldn't have been the canoe thing, but we did that in a large canoe, and we canoed through a particularly interesting place. So White Horse, named after the old White Horse Rapids, which aren't there anymore because of a dam that was placed on the Yukon River.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if I can get the story right. So back in the Gold Rush days, in the Klondike Gold Rush, especially in, say, 1898 sort of time period, people would hike over the Chilkoot Pass there, bring their one ton of goods, which is what the Mounties required them to bring to enter into the Klondike Gold Rush territory. Yep. And they would do 30 trips up and down this snow-covered pass. They're doing this in the wintertime up from Skagway across, and then they'd get to Bennett Lake. They'd build boats, and they would go down the river, and they'd come to these White Horse Rapids here, which are in a basalt-lined canyon, narrow canyon where the river got very rough. And again, the same superintendent of the Mounties who required you to bring your ton of goods, General Sir Samuel Benfield Steele, required that all the women and children get off the boat, that you unload your goods, and you could still run the rapids, but couldn't do it with the women and kids on there because it was dangerous. That is the area that we were canoeing, but it's now an easy float trip. Not so much a putting your life in your hands, but they would then take the boats all the way up then to Dawson City, which was then where you'd find the gold fields.
Coming down from the lake system, so Lake Bennett, Tagish Lake, Marsh Lake, and then mm-hmm. into the Yukon River proper, Miles Canyon that you paddled through would have been one set of rapids. The canyon would have been much deeper and the rapids more intense back in the Gold Rush, as you say, before the dam. And immediately after that were White Horse Rapids. So they're actually two very dangerous sets of rapids.
White Horse Rapids are, I think, where the White Horse Dam is then.
That's correct. There's still a little remnant of the White Horse Rapids below the dam that we canoeists and paddlers still enjoy. A little bit of White Horse jumping, but most of it's been flooded out. And certainly the canyon, as you say, is a very leisurely paddle now. It's
right.
Still strong current, so you should know what you're doing or take a guide, but it's a beautiful place to go through.
Now, for those who have more time and are more adventurous, you can do more than we just did. So I know you go off on week-long canoe trips, for instance, out into the wilderness. That is something that a tourist can arrange. How would they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of businesses based out of Whitehorse and some in Dawson City as well that will organize either a specific route that they're familiar with
mm-hmm.
for you, or you can step onto an already booked guided trip that has an itinerary and join as a one or a two if you wish along there, and that trip will go along. Or you can just rent the gear from them or rent the gear and a guide. So you could go on a completely unfamiliar river even to the regular tourists, but still have the comfort of knowing that your guide is an expert and the watercraft that you're going out in are top quality and that they've got the good tents and things like that. So really, the sky's the limit when it comes to canoeing and kayaking in the Yukon. That's one of our most popular summertime activities. We have people coming back here year after year for 20 or 30 years going down the river systems of the Yukon. And there's so many different rivers to choose from, like the Yukon River. Other than this little bit of rapids around Whitehorse and then a little bit further down halfway to Dawson City, it's a fairly flat paddle. We have things like the Big Salmon and Teslin rivers that are also very gentle, forgiving. They still have strong current, so people have mm-hmm. to understand the difference between a river and a lake, but excellent paddling. And then we have the central Yukon is full of whitewater rivers. The Wind, Snake, and Bonnet Plume rivers are three very well known up in the Peel River watershed. Those are fly-in destinations, so mm-hmm. a trip for those would be a little bit more expensive, but certainly a trip of a lifetime for many, many people. And the fact that you are out in the middle of the Yukon, very seldom will you see other people around there, but lots of animals. So those sort of remote trips are quite common as well. They tend to run in the 10-day to 2-week category.
Mm-hmm.
Anything from sort of 5 to 7 days, you're probably taking one of the rivers that are sort of more between the Whitehorse Dawson area, whether that's paddling a section of the Yukon River. There's the historic 30-mile section just below Lake LaBarge that'll take you down to Carmax, a small town on the way to Dawson City on the highway. Mm-hmm. You can go from Carmax to Dawson. So there's a number of different ways to break it up, and certainly there's many, many companies up here that would be happy to put a trip together for people. And there's also just general forums for people who are already canoeists and have their own boats and a gear, and they want to drive up and try it on their own, there's lots of forums and ways to get information to assist you in having accurate plans before you come.
I would just love to see one of the float planes that we drove by packed with, I think you said you can load up to 3 different canoes on a float plane to take it up there for a fly-in trip. And I just think that would be just fun to see, even if I didn't do the trip. So best time of year to do that, to get best weather, least amount of black flies?
June, July, and August are the normal months for canoeing. We will run through into September. In September, obviously, you're starting to get night returning, which brings a little bit of cool with it. But even up until the third and fourth week of September, the trips are great. Some of the more remote trips that we were referring to in terms of flying in those float planes, early June in a late summer year can be problematic because some of those lakes still have ice on
them. Right.
People planning for an early June trip will want to talk very closely with the organizers and pilots to make sure that the potential landing area is actually going to be where they get to land. But all through the summer, it's just an incredible thing. And again, that midnight sun, you know, when I grew up in Ontario back east, just up above New York State, we always had to worry about making camp in time and making dinner in time and getting into the tents before dark.
Right.
And I moved to the Yukon as a canoe guide and I was like, well, this is pretty easy, everybody, because we can just stay up till 2 a.m. and then put your tents because it's still light. So,
in fact, you may want to bring a eye shade if you're going to be sleeping outside in a tent.
Cause anybody who likes to sleep in the dark coming up in June, July, and August will definitely want to bring bandana or an eye shade, whatever you like. You get used to it after a little while, and certainly after 3 or 4 days, you're just tired enough. Your eyelids will be thick enough to close.
Well, and of course, there are a lot of critters in the area. We talked about the moose and the caribou, also bear country. So take appropriate precautions. And I think that's one of the advantages of going with a guide if you're going to do that.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of wildlife, we had a chance to get to see some without going out and doing the fly-in, which you just don't have time for own packed press trip, but we went to the Yukon Wildlife Preserve, which is very easy to do. If you're in Yukon, it's a short drive out to the Yukon Wildlife Preserve, and all of the animals there are ones that can be found in the Yukon, including, you know, bison and caribou and mountain goats, horned deer, Arctic foxes, all the things. And probably the most interesting one for me, I thought the moose would be, but musk oxen is the most ridiculous looking animal I've ever seen.
Musk ox are very cool.
Especially, and not generally found in the Whitehorse area.
No, they're not indigenous to this far. Not down in the banana belt.
Got a really thick coat to handle that Arctic weather. And of course, you know, all the animals at the Wildlife Preserve when you come in July are look a little motley because they've all shedding their big, thick winter coats, which you need for those cool nights in the Yukon in the wintertime.
Yeah, it's very true. Yeah, wildlife viewing is definitely one of the things people enjoy a lot on their times here, whether it's just I was paddling a little lake that's actually within city limits called Chadburn Lake, and we saw lynx on shore, and we just got to stare at it, and it stared at us for about 10 minutes. And it's just a beautiful experience to be there with the wildlife. The Wildlife Preserve is an amazing facility just north of town, as you say. Mm-hmm. Easy to get to, fantastic interpretation, so people get to learn a lot, not only about the animals and what their names are, but about their adaptation to the north and cold climates,
right,
which animals are moving in because the climates are changing these days. And so things like that, it's great to have that interpretation. And then as you go about your trip and you see an animal, I think it's a much more meaningful encounter for you later on, having a little bit of knowledge in your hand.
Right. Although the animals we saw outside the wildlife preserve, we saw bears a couple times walking across the road. Mm-hmm. We did not see those in the wildlife preserve, but
no, there's no bears or wolves yet in the wildlife preserve.
Not the carnivores. We had a tour from Who What Where Tours out of Whitehorse. You could also get a tour, as you say, from the wildlife preserve itself. Both, I thought, were wonderful. We did a 2-hour tour there and definitely worth doing. So I would recommend that for anybody who's in the Yukon who is in the Whitehorse area. The other thing, you mentioned doing a float trip. The one that we just missed, I guess, is we could have raced to on the Yukon River.
That's true.
From Whitehorse to Dawson, which is how far on the river?
That's about 750 kilometers. What's that in miles? About 480 miles?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. And so that's the Yukon River Quest that is Whitehorse to Dawson down the Yukon River, and that happens in June.
The end
shortly
of June.
After solstice. Yep, exactly. They try to time it with the most light so that those paddlers who are paddling 24 hours, basically, straight. I think the winners win it in just under 3 days, which is crazy.
That is crazy.
And those people definitely want to paddle all night long. So give them some light.
The crazy thing for me is when you started talking about canoers and kayakers and such, I was okay with that. When you talked about somebody doing it on a paddle board, I thought that was insane.
Well, and everybody except the paddle boards probably shakes their head at that. But yeah, they've added a paddle board category. I think 2 years ago was the inaugural attempt and everything was a success. In fact, I think one of the paddle boards placed in the top three or five in the first year.
It's so crazy. Yeah,
they proved that they were extremely competitive with the rest of the field. And my understanding is that they're now a full-fledged category.
Cool. Well, and the other festival that I wanted to mention is the one that I was there for, which is the Adaka Festival. And that is a festival that happens. Is it always around the 4th of July? It's always in that in July, I believe.
Correct. It's always the first week of July. It usually starts somewhere around the 30th or 31st of June. Okay. And will run for a week. It's the most popular and most well-known First Nations cultural festival in the Yukon today. And it brings First Nations artists and entertainers and cultural presentations from around North America, but with a focus on that's indigenous to the northern areas. And this year, the focus was on canoes. So they were building...
Well, you say canoes, watercraft here, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So there was a canoe, kayak...
Dugout.
A moose-skin boat and then a dugout canoe as well.
Right.
And next year there will be a different focus and the year after that there will be a different focus. But there's always something that's extremely engaging and also very educational about First Nations culture, both as a North American phenomenon, but also that which is specific to the Yukon.
I think you undersold the watercraft this year. Unfortunately, you won't see it if you go next year. But what they did this year, as we said, is the watercraft, those four different types. But they weren't just showing them off. They made them in the traditional fashion. And they
had
the people who made the dugout canoe, the birch bark canoe, the sealskin kayak. It takes about 7 sealskins, in case you're keeping track. And the moose skin boat. And that was the strangest one to me. I'd never heard of a moose skin boat. And that's apparently kind of a temporary boat that you carried the pieces with you. And then at the end of the fur trapping season, you sort of put together your moose skin boat, sailed it once down the river, and then got your pelts back to the camp and then took it apart again.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one that didn't quite do the launch well there because it was leaking a little water. They had to go back and do some repairs, but they had to relearn how to make some of these watercraft. In fact, they had lost some of the knowledge of this and had to go back to some of the historical records and see what people had written about them and such. Fascinating. And then, of course, as they launched these in a big ceremony on the last day of the festival and went down the river, which was good fun, they're also launching a Maori canoe because the Maori had brought representatives to share in their, I want to say, common indigenous cultures.
Yes.
We went to the festival 3 different nights and saw a great variety of musical groups. We saw 3 different groups. One that was, I would just say, a bluegrass duo, except that they were First Nations, Native American people. And the next one was the Northern Cree Singers, who were much more traditional. You got to look up the Northern Cree Singers on YouTube to understand what I'm talking about. But they're doing traditional melodies and traditional drums. And then they're singing sometimes traditional lyrics, and other times they're singing about why I unfriended you on Facebook. So it's an odd thing. Now, and I'll be honest, I wrote this up in the article that will be out before this comes out, that I would have enjoyed them more if they'd had a little more variety in their tunes. I think they had one tune and many, many different verses, but they have sung at the Grammys and things like that. So interesting. And then I think, for me, probably the most interesting was there was another group that was called Twin Flames. They were singing, I want to say, First Nations folk songs. And they were singing in English, French, and Inuit.
Mm-hmm.
He was Inuit, and I had a variety of backgrounds. And then that was just a haunting melodies and such. And one of the things they were singing about, well, the song that actually got them invited, the Porch Light song, was about the First Nations women disappearing. And I'll have a link in the article about this to the Campaign on Missing and Murdered Inuit Women to bring some publicity. That is not something I knew was an issue, but you can read more about that on the blog post. But a fascinating cultural festival, if you're interested in that, that is something that you can attend again the first week in July. Are there other festivals that you would highlight in terms of a great time to be in the Yukon is for this at this time?
There is another First Nations festival that just wrapped up in Teslin, Yukon, which is just to the south of Whitehorse. It is biannual, so happens every second year, and it is in the odd numbered years. In even number of years, there's what's called the Moosehide Festival, which is also First Nations. but it's north of Dawson City. So we actually have two very diverse festivals every year. The second one, happening around this time of year, late July, is either north or south of Whitehorse, and that one alternates year to year. We also have an array of music festivals. Dawson City Music Festival just wrapped up a couple of weekends ago. That's probably the most famous one here. Atland Music Festival is in northern British Columbia, but the only highway there comes from the Yukon and goes back to the Yukon. So
that's
an adopted sister community. Correct. I was just down in Atland. That's another good musical festival.
Stephen abandoned us on the last day of the trip because he had a music festival to get to. So
I left a little early. In terms of the history of the Yukon, obviously the First Nations history predates the arrival of Europeans. Europeans were here in the 1800s. I mean, at one point in history of European history, they thought the Yukon River was four different rivers until somebody traveled down the whole length and went, hey, wait a minute, this is just one river. And so that discovery by non-First Nations people is very recent, only 150 years ago.
Right.
So the history of the gold rush, the Klondike gold rush of 1898, all of that is still here and waiting. And traveling to Europe and going and seeing 1,000-year-old castles and things like that is amazing in one way. What I enjoy about the history of the Yukon is it's so fresh. It's young. And you quite often will get a chance to actually meet someone who's directly connected either through their parents or their grandparents with some of the historical stories that you're hearing about. Certainly if you go and talk to the First Nations elders and listen to their stories at something like Adaka or to one of our cultural festivals or one of the cultural centers on a regular day of the week, you're listening to people who are part of history. You're not just listening to some story that is, you know, about unknown people thousands of years ago. So that's kind of amazing as well.
Well, and you mentioned history. Of course, the one history that kept coming up and you ought to read up on before you go is the Klondike Gold Rush history, because it's so much made the Yukon what it is now, because that mining went on in the Yukon. Well, mining is probably still going on in the Yukon, but I think a lot of it closed up in the 1950s. No, 1980s, sorry, when the mining was tailing off a little bit. But for instance, our next thing that we did is we rode on the White Pass and Yukon Route Railroad, and that went over not the Chilkoot Pass that people were hiking over, but the next pass over, and really replaced that whole arduous journey that people were doing originally as they were hiking in with an easy railroad ride. And then you would take the railroad down, and this is so we're now in like 1898 to 1900. I think 1900 opened, if I'm remembering correctly. And by that point, you can go down there and get on a paddle wheeler and just go up the Yukon all the way up to the gold fields. And the paddle wheelers ran until the 1950s, and the railroad shut down in the 1980s. And then now it opened up and it carries tourists. Beautiful railroad ride. You get to stop and one stop only from what we did. We did the stop basically from the Canadian borders, because we had a press trip with a lot of people with international passports, and it would get a lot more complicated if we'd gone all the way from Skagway, which is what most of the people do. Most of the people are coming from a cruise ship on the Inland Passage, and they're riding up over the top to Carcross, which is where it ends, which has nothing to do with cars.
Not at all.
So, I love the fact that Carcross is a shortened form of Caribou Crossing, just because Caribou Crossing is not a term we use for a lot of local towns in my area.
No.
Although, you talk about wildlife sighting, this has nothing to do with the Yukon, but this morning I went out for a walk very early and had two coyotes walking down my street. So there's sometimes wildlife where you would not expect it. But no caribou. We've got no caribou. Two interesting things about the Yukon, White Pass and Yukon Railroad that I thought, three among the interesting things are that when you stop at Bennett Lake, there's a little tiny museum there where you can see a movie about the trip that it would have been during the time of the gold rush. So that's definitely stop and see that. And then they have just a small display of a guy standing there with a ton of goods because they were required to have just a ton of goods, but a year's worth of supply and very specific supplies. You have to have this, you have to have that. And so they'll give you a picture of what that was that they were trying to get to the gold rush there. And it's a lot of goods.
Yeah.
We did a quick hike up into the old town of Bennett, which is mostly not there anymore. Not the whole lot of the buildings left, but there's a lovely church up the hill there that we went to. You could see the outside of. One of the buildings that's not there anymore, just for my American listeners in this little bit of trivia, you can no longer hike to the Arctic Restaurant and Hotel and brothel that was run by a German immigrant, Frederick Trump. And if the name sounds familiar, that's where the start of the Trump fortune happened. That's the grandfather of current President Donald Trump. Made his fortune in part in the Yukon, not by trying to mine for gold, but by trying to mine for gold miners.
Mm-hmm.
And then Carcross. Carcross surprised me. Interesting little town. What I expect to see, I'll be honest, at the end of a tourist railroad is a shop where I can buy a t-shirt that says my grandparents went to the Yukon and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. I mean, that's that's really what I expected. And you can get that t-shirt there, I'm sure. There is definitely t-shirt shops. But the part that I thought was really interesting was that there is a First Nations cultural development area, economic development area there, where they have a number of different shops that have more interesting souvenirs and crafts from the First Nations people. And of course, we had a chance to meet with a local wood carver there who is carving. And I want to say totem poles because that is what I've known them from my youth being, and I did not realize how many different types of poles there were in the Tlingit culture, for instance, that you had clan poles that represent a particular clan, and they've got the clan's animal on them that represents. So you'd put that in front of your, for instance, these days, as they're creating different cultural centers for the different clans, that you might have that in front of the cultural center. Or you might have the two from the two local clans.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways they kept these small populations from inbreeding was that you couldn't marry somebody from your same clan, and your clan was determined by your mother. And so you'd always have at least two clans locally. There are story poles, and that's what I think of as a totem pole. Memorial poles dedicated to somebody. Debt poles, which I thought was a great idea. So you owe me money. I'm going to put a pole in your yard. I'm going to carve a pole. This seems like a lot of – you must owe me a lot of money, Stephen. If I'm carving a pole and putting it in your yard, and I get to keep it in your yard so that everybody knows you owe me money until you pay the debt.
I think we could use a few of those today just to make people a little bit more honest.
Right. We have mortuary poles, potlatch poles, and we have humility poles, and I don't even know what that is. But it was interesting watching what he was doing in that. There are a number of different, and again, I'm using the generic term totem pole, which I know is incorrect, in that center there in Carcross. Also, pretty good smelling restaurants and some pretty good ice cream shops. So not bad for a little tourist destination there.
We've seen Carcross definitely rise in terms of stature and facilities and activities for guests in the last few years. And certainly Keith Wolf Smarch, who is the artist you've been referring to as the totem pole carver. And he would call it a totem pole as well. He would probably be more specific in terms of which kind of totem pole,
right?
But also the masks and paddles and other things that are being carved there. And he has created quite a little carving community around Carcross and in other places, so people can actually see these things happening in person, but then go home with a souvenir that's reminiscent of their trip there. But right. Carcross is a fascinating little place, and yeah, we just had a little time to poke around. It's a great place to explore, and again, a lot of hikes based out of there, so a great place to go for your hike and then come back for that gelato or espresso or whatever you need at the end of the hike.
Now, the one place I did not get to see, which I think you would probably recommend people do see, is Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
What should they do there?
Yeah, absolutely. Dawson City, I mean, there is an expression, especially in Dawson City, that says you haven't been to the Yukon unless you've been to Dawson City. And we will echo that on their behalf. Definitely the home of the Klondike Gold Rush, the sort of the epicenter of the Yukon, if you will. That is Dawson City. And today, Dawson City lives very much in a thematic similarity that it did years ago. At the turn of the century, at the turn of the 1900s, you know, the highest number of millionaires per capita lived in Dawson City. It was the first town or city to have electrical streetlights. So the history that is in that one place, and you mentioned,
it was the capital at that time as well.
It definitely was the capital of the whole Yukon. Whitehorse was just a transfer between boats and trains. It wasn't really much of a place to go do anything with. Dawson City, obviously the Klondike Gold Rush history is prevalent there. Mm-hmm. The First Nations history of that area is very, very strong. There's incredible wilderness areas just outside of Dawson City. Tombstone Territorial Park, which is one of Our mainstays for hiking, Kluane National Park is over in Haines Junction, up near Dawson City is Tombstone. And then that also leads you to the Dempster Highway, which is the only all-season road in Canada that crosses the Arctic Circles. So you could come up here on the 21st of June and toast champagne at midnight with the sun in your eyes. That's kind of a neat idea there.
Now, how far is that from Dawson?
The Arctic Circle to drive to is probably about another 6 hours. It's okay. Only about 400 kilometers, so about 300 miles, 320 miles. But the road can be slow going, and if there's been any rain, it can get quite slick, so you want to drive safe. It's also a very spectacular road, so you'll end up stopping a lot and getting out of the car, taking pictures. So you want to give yourself a good amount of time and do a little bit of research before you take off, because the first gas station after Dawson City is about 220 miles up. So you'll want to do your homework on that one before you just take off. But road tripping in general is amazing through the whole Yukon. Dawson has its own flavor there. Part of the Yukon highway system is actually a ferry boat that goes across the Yukon River right in Dawson City, and it'll take you to West Dawson and then up what's called the Top of the World Highway, which crosses the border into Alaska and then becomes the Taylor Highway to come around on a big loop that will bring you back through Kluane. But Dawson is everything from Canada's oldest legal casino, Diamond Tooth Gertie's, that has nightly entertainment, and you can win your fortune back. And everybody who loses contributes to the betterment of the town, because it all goes to common good civil initiatives, to taking a walk with the Parks Canada staff through one of the many, many historical sites that's been preserved from the Gold Rush era. You can take a quick trip out to the dredge, one of the largest dredging machines that was built in the Klondike. And then you just stand there in front of this massive machine and you think, how in God's name did they get all of this material up here? How did they get these buckets? How did they get all of the other things? Well, and you alluded to it earlier, you came up by train from the west to Whitehorse, then you loaded all that on a boat, went down the river or up the, well, down the river, but north to Dawson City, and then you started to build it there. So Dawson has a real flavor. People expect it to be a little bit Walt Disney-like in that it's kind of fake and doesn't feel authentic. But it's quite the opposite. When you're walking down the streets, there's still wooden sidewalks and mud streets because there's just no point in trying to change some of that stuff. You feel like you're 100 years ago in time and you're walking down the old Klondike frontier. It's quite an amazing place to go, and I really encourage guests who have any more than just a couple of days in the Yukon to really make a point of getting up to Dawson City and soaking that up. Summertime, obviously, it's the height of season there.
Right.
Very, very busy. But wintertime in Dawson, everything goes kind of sleepy, but it's still there. It's still this remnant place that's out on the frontier in a bright light in the middle of the cold night. Wintertime in Dawson can be spectacular as well.
Well, and you mentioned wintertime. It's a surprise to me, I would have to say, how much tourism Yukon gets in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
I did not realize how much Northern Lights tourism there is in the Yukon now.
No, it's true. The Northern Lights are on everybody's bucket list, it seems, in the last 5 or so years. And the Yukon is an amazing place to see it. We are obviously far enough north that we're under that sort of auroral halo around the North Magnetic Pole. So we do have Northern Light phenomena here. I've seen them as early as early August, like August 7th.
Wow.
The real viewing season sort of starts in the last week of August, once the skies are a little darker than dark blue. And then aurora season will last right up. I've seen them in the middle of May, but again, the sort of typical aurora season winds down by the end of April. Again, mostly to give yourself the darker nights to view them. People always want to come up in the summer and say, oh, I'd like to go on a canoe trip in July and see the Northern Lights. It's, well, you can't, because the sky is too bright in the summer to see the Northern Lights. But by the middle of August, the sky is starting to feel dark blue again, and they'll come along. But certainly, you know, September is an amazing month if people want to avoid sort of the cold but still see the Northern Lights. And then January, February, March are always spectacular. It's not on every night, but most of our operators in the Whitehorse area run a three-night, three-day package. And with three nights in a row, their success rate is over 95% in terms of viewing the lights. So very, very well received product. And as you say, it's really put the Yukon on the map in terms of winter tourism. Back when I was a guide for dog sled trips, people would come up for week-long dog sledding trips. And now we're seeing many, many, many more people coming up for Northern Lights and going on a half-day dog sledding trip just to see what it's like to be on a dog sled. But the winter is spectacular. And I think for some people, in the same way that the Northern Lights are iconic and the Midnight Sun is iconic, For some people, cold is iconic. And for some, your guests who are listening from Texas or Florida are going to be shivering already when I just say the word. But when it's minus 30 Celsius or minus 40, and Celsius and Fahrenheit meet at minus 40. So when I say minus 40, I'm talking both scales. Mm-hmm. That's a magic of its own. You have to be properly dressed and hopefully travel with somebody who knows what they're doing, even if you're in a car. But to experience that yourself and to feel what that feels like on your face and to open your hand for a minute and to feel, oh my gosh, yeah, all my heat is disappearing now. And then to go back into a nice warm cabin or back to your hotel or to a restaurant and warm back up. So that's an incredible feeling.
You mentioned that you used to be a dog sled guide, or that you used to do dog sled guide tours, and also were involved, as I recall, with, I want to call it the Canadian version of the Iditarod, which is probably the incorrect way to say it to somebody from Yukon Tours or Tourism Yukon.
It's not its official name. The official name of the race is the Yukon Quest International Sled Dog Race.
There we go.
Similar to the Iditarod, it's 1,000 miles long. Unsimilar to the Iditarod, it's international. It crosses between Canada and the U.S., between mm-hmm. Alaska and the Yukon, and it runs inland. So where the Iditarod gets out to the coast and runs around to Nome at its finish, the Yukon Quest stays inland the whole time and basically runs on the old trails that the miners and trappers would have used around the time of the Klondike Gold Rush. And the whole theme of it is that back 115, 20 years ago, you had to be completely independent. If you struck out with your dogs and you're trying to travel from one place to another, you were on your own and you had to have your wits about you and take care of your animals and understand the trail and how to survive in the winter. Otherwise, you wouldn't have made it. And so the race today is reminiscent of that era where mushers are expected to travel independently on their own, take care of their animals, and succeed in getting to the next destination along the trail. It's an amazing event to see and just to be witness to and part of. And certainly if people come along and to the start of the race and get to the banquet and meet the mushers and talk to them in advance, you start to get an appreciation for the kind of humans who are still attracted to traveling by dog team, which in the modern era of speedboats and motorcycles and things like that, going along at 8 or 9 miles an hour may not seem so thrilling. But for people who have tried it, I know a lot of them have had a very emotional experience and connection with the land and the animals while they've been on the back of a dog sled, even on a tour, a 3-hour tour. So imagine going for several days at a time and mm-hmm. quite literally your life is dependent on those animals and they are dependent on you. So this reciprocity of this is one team with maybe 12 or 13 or 15 different players on it. Or if you're just on your little sled, then you may have 4 dogs or 5 dogs, but incredible, incredible winter experience. And certainly dog sledding belongs in the Yukon. It was used here as the safest, most reliable form of transportation in our winters. And it still is used today. And the Yukon Quest commemorates all that.
Excellent. We need to start wrapping this up because Stephen's already gone much longer than I promised him it would go. So, but I don't want to end without talking about food, because mm-hmm. I would say in Whitehorse, which is really where we were eating most of the meals, except for the wonderful meal that we ate at a resort on the last day, and I'm going to draw a complete blank on where we went to.
You were in Southern Lakes Resort down by Carcross on your last day.
Except for that wonderful meal. And that really was a wonderful resort. I would recommend that. So I thought we were going to come up and we were going to eat caribou. Mm-hmm. And pretty much that was, you're going to have caribou and wasn't sure what else there was going to be. I wasn't expecting that I would be eating Jamaican food. I would be eating toboggan food. Toboggan food.
Yeah.
From Trinidad and Tobago. So I wasn't expecting that. I wasn't expecting that I would be introduced to Saganaki flaming Greek cheese. I was a little surprised by the variety. Now, I know that there were other more touristy restaurants that we didn't go to that would be the large portions of steak and things like that, or the salmon. You were largely going to places that you like, which is the great thing about running a press trip.
It's true. We're quite blessed here for a number of reasons. In the whole Yukon, to start in Whitehorse, the arts community, the cultural community, and obviously the cuisine community. So we only scratched the surface of a few of the restaurants during your visit that we could have gone to, and it runs the gamut. It's from your regular fast food takeout stuff all the way up to gourmet fare. And I think what really sort of floors visitors is the fact that you can go all the way up to gourmet fare. As you said, you don't expect to find ethnic foods or foods that are prepared for you by seasoned chefs. There are some of the resorts, Southern Lakes Resort, Inn on the Lake, Northern Lights Resort and Spa, Boreal Ranch, a bunch of other ones that I don't have time to mention, but their resident chefs are excellent as well. Mm-hmm. So around the Whitehorse area, you know, everything from the food trucks that are lining the street in the summertime to the restaurants, and then out towards Haines Junction, there are excellent restaurants as well. You were down in Carcross. There were restaurants that are right in town, as well as Southern Lakes Resort, just out of town. Up in Dawson City, again, another sort of impressive and perhaps unexpected array of restaurants, very much in the summertime. A few of them will be open in the winter as well. For your tummy, the Yukon is also a great place to go, and I like to say to people, don't plan on coming into the Yukon and losing weight.
Well, I believe that's exactly what you told me. So,
yep.
Which was true, sadly. But what restaurant did we not get to? Because I'll write up a blog post about the number of the different ones we had with pictures and things like that. What other one would you recommend for people?
Klondike Rib and Salmon is the tent down on 2nd Avenue that had the line up there that we did not get into.
Well, that's more of a traditional tourist restaurant. I think that's where a lot of people would go.
Yeah. Or they'd be dissuaded by the lineup and maybe not go.
That's right.
I don't think we went to Giorgio's, did we? Or did we?
Is that one of the two Greek brothers that are competing against each other? Yes, we went to.
Well, yeah.
We went to both of those.
We did go to both. Okay, then.
Yeah. We had Saganaki Flaming Greek Cheese twice. So not the last time I will have it, too, I will have to say.
No, I just had some the other night, actually. The Wheelhouse Restaurant is further down 2nd Avenue, close to where the Adaka Festival was, just a little bit beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Downtown, 506 Grill, there's Sanchez Cantina, which is authentic Mexican, just to throw another ethnic twist at you. Olivita Sanchez goes back to Mexico every winter for a couple of, well, usually about a month and a half, but otherwise you're getting homemade Mexican food in Whitehorse. The Miner's Daughter is on Main Street, the former Capital Hotel. That's excellent. And I'm going to try a new place out, the Restaurant of the Town and Mountain, which has just received a new chef less than 2 months ago. And I'm curious to check out their new menus.
And the other interesting thing for me with the ethnic mix is that it wasn't like there were a lot of people here who grew up in Whitehorse and decided they really liked Jamaican food.
No.
I met a lot of people who were speaking with accents that were not a Yukon accent, if there is a Yukon accent.
It probably is, eh?
Yeah, people who had moved in from Switzerland and Germany and Trinidad and Tobago and Jamaica and such. So it is a growing area, and it's interesting how many people were attracted to, I think they were number one attracted to the open space, was the number one thing that I was hearing from people.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently cold, but I can't picture that at all. So I can picture it in the summertime. Absolutely. It's not hard for me to picture. I'll have to reserve my opinions on the wintertime until I actually have been there. So
it sounds good.
As we wrap this up, Stephen, is there anything else that people need to know before they go to the Yukon?
I always call it the domestic exotic, which may not fit for American guests, but it feels like an exotic place, even though you're still in Canada. And for Americans, you're still in North America. And so the notion that most U.S. visitors have of Canada being to the north of them, our Alaskan friends think of us as being east.
Right.
And just that juxtaposition of where things are. My great brag that I live so far north in Canada, I drive south to Alaska. Take a look at a map. I actually do.
Yes.
And it's just that oddity that I think that most people are going to want to see something that is quite unlike anything else they've seen, and that's waiting for them up here.
Right.
Whether it's just the sunlight at midnight, or whether it is the northern lights overhead, or whether it's some kind of an activity that they've chosen to do that brings them to a place where they stand on a hill and they look around 360 degrees and they don't see a single thing that looks like it's been made by humans. It's all natural. Mm-hmm. That's an incredibly rare experience these days. And I think that that allows people to really touch something that's deep inside themselves and to start maybe really feeling what it's like to be alive. So I think that's some of the beauty that the Yukon has to offer and some of the joy that our visitors speak of as they return home and quite often return again and again.
Two things that I would say, too, before we wrap this up. One is there are a lot of people who've never thought about going to the Yukon who are listening, some of whom, though, have thought about driving the Alaskan Highway, which goes right through Whitehorse. So with the Alaskan Highway, you can't get to Alaska without driving through the Yukon. So
you have to come right through the Yukon. And the Alaska Highway, well, this year, 2017, is its 75th anniversary. Mm-hmm. It's half the age of our country, which are celebrating 150 years, and was built in the middle of the Second World War in 1942, in a record time of just over between eight and 10 months. Incredible feat considering how the terrain is and how little was known about it and all that. But to drive the Alaska Highway today is truly one of the road trips of a lifetime. It's iconic. It's beautiful. The highway is in much better condition than it was back in 1942.
That was what surprised me is I had this picture of, well, you talked about people used to drive the Alaska Highway with multiple spare tires and really ready for that kind of thing.
Exactly. And fuel.
And fuel, yeah. And I would have to say that driving the Alaska Highway was not on my to-do list until after now my trip here to Whitehorse and to the Yukon. And now it's one of those, I would like to do that someday. Because I enjoyed the stretch that we did, but also seeing how easy that is to drive now, comparatively to the mental picture I had. Flaming cheese while I'm driving through Whitehorse, too.
You're going through Whitehorse. You can probably get some on Dawson City as well.
There you go. There you go.
Which will take you onto the North Klondike Highway, a little bit out of the way, but you can always loop back through Token, Alaska, and come back to the Alaska Highway on a big circle route if you want.
One thing that makes you laugh and say only in the Yukon.
Well, we have this quaint way of referring to outside, which means basically anything that's south of us. When we speak, we say, well, what'd you do last weekend? We say we went outside. If we were writing it, we'd use a capital O. And it means if we went down to Vancouver or Seattle, we went outside. But if I just went down to Skagway or over to Fairbanks, that was not outside. I was still, for lack of a better word, inside, although we'll never use the term inside. So the use of the word outside tells you that you're listening to somebody who has lived here for a little while and is used to that kind of terminology. Huh. Another oddity, as you've experienced, is going up to Dawson City.
Right.
Or going down to Dawson City. There, I just inversed it myself. So the oddity of going down river to Dawson, although now you drive a highway instead of taking the riverboat, the terminology, the taxonomy, if you will, still stays the same. So people in Dawson will always correct you if you say you just drove up from Whitehorse. They will be quick to tell you you drove down from Whitehorse, which is great. What's the strangest? I don't know if there's just one strange Yukon thing. We're a bit of a mixed breed here. There's an old expression that says, unless you were born here, you're either running from something or running to something. That idea that once you experience the Yukon for yourself, whether it's on a short vacation or a longer stay, you'll know very quickly, probably within a few days or a couple of weeks, or if you're actually planning to live here a couple of months, whether it's for you or not. And that instantaneous knowledge that this is a place that I love and I would like to come back to, that sits in people and can get under their skin quite quickly and easily. And so that sense of having been to the North is always in you a little bit. And I think that is a good thing because not very many people make it here. Not many people make that effort to drive to Alaska or fly into the Yukon. And when they do, they're rewarded with a very rich memory and something that stays with them for years. And as they tell their stories, they inspire others to think north.
Excellent. Last two questions. You're standing in the prettiest spot in the Yukon. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I'd say you're standing on the Icefield Discovery landing strip at 8,500 feet looking at Mount Logan.
Sounds
you
pretty
bastard.
Good. And if you had to summarize the Yukon in three words, what three words would you use?
Hospitality.
Okay.
Spectacular.
Okay.
And natural.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, our guest again has been Stephen Reynolds from Tourism Yukon. We'll have links to Tourism Yukon's website. The other thing I should say is I almost didn't get Stephen on because he was pretty sure that this might be useful for Tourism Yukon, but probably wouldn't help him get a date. So if somebody could solve that problem for me by proving him wrong, I would appreciate it. So just let me know.
Thanks for all your help, Chris.
And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great to chat with you. Hope to see you up here again.
In news of the community, I don't want to be too long as this is already a long episode. I am just back from a cruise in the Mediterranean, which we'll be talking about, I think, on next week's episode, possibly the one after that. And then we went just with one day turnaround. I was home for one day and went to San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, where I had a chance, as I mentioned last week, to meet up with three different travel podcasters, which was great fun. And then with a 5-day turnaround, it was supposed to be a 4-day turnaround, but we needed to avoid a big hurricane in Houston, Texas. We were going to be flying through Houston the day the hurricane hit. So instead, we came home a day early through Los Angeles, but we are off to New York City. In fact, when you hear this, I should be in New York City, or at least if you hear this the day that it comes out, spending some time with a family trip and then heading up to Maine and Nova Scotia. I don't think this will affect our release schedule. I think I can get far enough ahead to get a show out every week during this trip, but if not, I hope you will understand that it means that spending time with my two adult kids took priority. I think you can understand that. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. I'm hoping you can still join us for our India tour in 2017 in November, but time is starting to run out for that. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. And thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cup.